Yeah, you know what you can get me, Pee-wee?
What?
El Hombre.
First of all, as a service to the listeners, this is an absolute forget about it.
El Hombre.
El Hombre is brought to you by LoanEstimateReview.com.
El Hombre.
He's a pariah. It's like going after raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens.
El Hombre.
The 5 o'clock refresh is brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, made to chill. It happens every Tuesday at 5 o'clock here with Bob, Dave, and more. We bring in the one, the only, El Hombre, Michael Bradley, with us. Michael, how are you, man?
What's happening, everybody?
Hey, just talking sports out here. And I was, I don't know if you heard that little promo coming in before you're open there. That was audio of LeBron James talking about back in 2011 when there was the lockout in basketball. He considered, you know, training to play at the NFL level. And we were having a little debate or just a discussion. I was debating some of the texters saying, listen, I acknowledge LeBron's one of the great athletes, one of the best to ever touch a basketball. I'm not debating any of that. But he hadn't played competitive football since his junior year in high school, so never even played his senior year or college ball, obviously. And at that point was, I think, 8 or 9 years removed from that junior year of football. So the idea that he was going to just train and play in the NFL is a big stretch. I guess if anybody could do it, it would be him. But if I were a betting man, I would be betting against it. What do you think?
I agree 100%. I mean, what people forget about professional sports, the highest level of sports, is that it's not just, are you a great athlete? What's your technique? And here's the other thing. LeBron played football in junior, as a junior, and was it junior high or junior year in high school?
Junior in high school.
He was probably bigger than everybody else. No one was hitting him the way NFL people would hit him. His technique would be rudimentary at best, and it's not like he could have plenty of time to learn it and to hone it. So to think, oh, I'm going to run faster and lift more weights and I'm going to be a pro football player. No way. I think he would have been somebody who was, you know, could have acquitted himself all right, but he is no way he would have been a star. And I would have liked to see what happened the first time somebody really hit him, because he doesn't get hit. And I'm not saying that he bounces up and goes, yeah, do it again. But maybe he's like, geez, I want to get back on a basketball court.
Yeah, so who do you think is the best convert as far as that? You got Julius Peppers, you got Jimmy Graham. Who else am I missing?
Antonio Gates.
Yeah.
But Tony those Gonzalez, guys who do you think is the best? Football in college.
Right.
You know, this
who's the best basketball player converted to a football player?
Well, That's probably it. I mean, but those guys also played football. I mean, Tony Gonzalez, I saw him play basketball for Cal. He was a very good basketball player, but he was also a really good football player. And that's what his best sport was. You know, there's a reason LeBron James started playing basketball. It's that he was better at it than he was as a football player. Now, he's the best player in the game right now. He's the second or third best player of all time. But just because he's the, you know, I don't think Magic Johnson would have been a great football player. I don't know if Michael Jordan would have been a great football player. In high school or college, yeah, sure, you put an athlete out there, you do some things for him, and he helps you. But we're talking about the best players in the world. And here's the other thing. There would definitely be some resentment among the NFL if LeBron James came in and said, oh, I'm going to be a football player now, everybody. They would be like, okay, yeah, all right, we'll see if you're a football player, pal.
Yeah, 253 and 425 texting in George Fant playing basketball at Western Kentucky. He was playing offensive line for the Seahawks and now with the Jets. So, but at least that's a local
one
angle
catch
there. Now, Michael, what's that?
He's got one catch, remember?
He does have one catch. Yeah, that's right. Okay, Michael, last week we were going back and forth about MLB and whether they're going to come back or not, and you were on the player side, I was on the owner's side. Where are you this week? Are you pessimistic, optimistic, or somewhere in between that we're going to see baseball this summer?
I'm leaning a little bit more towards pessimistic because of everything that has to happen. You know, baseball went out and put this 67-page or however many page treatise together describing what it's going to take for them to play, and they didn't consult a single person in any of the cities where they're supposed to play. They're going to need 200,000 tests, all right, and they're going to need the tests to be read and formulated rather quickly. That's not happening right now, and I can tell you, not from personal experience, but from very close experience in my family, it takes a while to get the test back now. So you know, and if what happened, then they're saying if one person gets it on the team, they're going to just quarantine him. They're not going to quarantine the whole team. Well, he's been in the locker room. He's been on the field. All of a sudden, you're just going to say, well, we don't spread it anymore? The numbers are still the numbers. A person who is positive can infect, even if he's in asymptomatic, can infect six people who can then go infect six and, you know, and to quote the old shampoo commercial, and so on and so on and so on. So there's a lot that has to happen, and everybody's getting this itch. We need to get back. We need to get back. Yeah, it would be great to get back, and it would be great to have baseball. I would love to see baseball, but it's not something that we are. It's foolproof once it comes back. There's so many variables, and you could have dozens of players testing positive for this, and then all of a sudden, other players start saying, "I don't want to be test. I don't want to be near these guys because not only don't I want to test positive, I don't want to bring it home to my family."
I don't remember if we asked you this last week or not, Michael, but we were talking about football starting and it'd be with no fans. And, you know, that gives you a little bit more time than baseball. But assuming it goes, we had heard that Fox was talking, or Joe Buck was talking about them piping in crowd noise and putting virtual fans in the stands. If we asked you this, I apologize. But what is your take on that? Because I just feel like that's such a horrible idea.
I think you're going to need some kind of fan noise in there. Just watching the golf the other day. So the guy hits a great shot. You hear the ball hit the ground, and then that's that. It really takes away from the overall feeling of it. And again, I've said it before, if you haven't eaten ice cream for a year and someone gives you a single scoop of vanilla, you're going to be like, okay, I'm happy to have it. But will you be happy to have it long term? We're starved for sports, but will people stay with it if it's in an atmosphere in a situation that they're not used to and they're not comfortable with? Maybe they become comfortable with it. I know gamblers are going to say, great, we get stuff to bet on. It doesn't matter whether there's crowds or not. We're just playing. We're just taking a look at the outcome of the game. But the fans are saying, is this going to be the, you know, the same way we turn on a game and we see nobody in the stands? We don't hear any crowd noise at all when a home run gets hit or somebody gets struck out with two on in the ninth. The players can't celebrate, right? I thought about that the other day. I strike out the batter to end the game, and the catcher can't come out and shake my hand. Everybody's got to stand 6 feet apart and jump up and down. It's really going to look different.
All right, I don't know if you saw the efforts from the South Korean soccer club as far as putting people, virtual fans. What's a better idea, what they did or, you know, possibly, you know, putting it some graphic in there, because that didn't turn out
too well. Well, it depends. Are we going to be using sex dolls like they did?
Yeah. All right.
They said they were mannequins, Michael. They called them mannequins.
Okay, is that what they called them over? That's what they called over there?
That's what they said they were.
I think filling it with mannequins is a little odd, right? Filling it with virtual crowds, if it's done right and there's no gaps, like, you know, you're on a Zoom call and you have a background or something and the person's face is half being seen and, you know, or it's drifting into the background or whatever, you know, are we going to have problems with players up to bat and we're not going to be able to see them because the green screen behind them is a little strange? I don't know. I don't understand the technology enough. If it looks real and they can do it, I'm all for it. But again, it's going to be different no matter what they try to do.
What do you think is going to be the strangest thing about what we're going to see? You mentioned some of the things about not celebrating. I was wondering how these guys are not going to be able to spit anymore. I was also wondering about no litter in the dugouts. I mean, there's all kinds of different things. I mean, everybody's wearing masks in the dugout. What stands out to you with baseball, the new way?
I think the look is just going to be that, right? I couldn't go 3 hours without spitting. Are you kidding me? You're not going to see the guys eating sunflower seeds anymore. You're going to have people on the bench and maybe in the stands in masks. I can't wait till the first story comes out that says the players are not performing as well because they're paying so much attention to things they have to do in the protocols that's what's controlling their minds and they're not able really to get ready to go up and hit the ball the way they are. You're going to be changing behaviors drastically. You know, they always say, oh, baseball clubhouse is a sanctuary. A dugout is a place where a guy can be a guy, scratch, spit, do what you want to do. Well, now you can't do that. you're not allowed to do any of that stuff. Can't touch your face. And there's going to be the coronavirus police out there, going to be watching games carefully to see who did what in the dugout. The Padres have a 72% scratch rate. The Rays have 43% of their players touching their faces. You know, this is awful. They're not good examples for America's youths. So there's going to be all sorts of fallout from this as these guys try to do what's right and still try to play baseball at the highest level.
Well, the one that caught me, Michael, was that they are not allowed to lick their fingers. And think about every time you see that catcher throw the ball back to the pitcher, what does he do? He steps off the rubber, licks his fingers, wipes it on his pants. I mean, it's every pitcher, every single pitch almost, and that's ingrained. They've been doing that since probably junior high, high school, college, whatever they've done, the minors. How do you just stop that? I mean, if you're that dialed into a game, I could see them losing focus. Like, okay, I got to make sure I don't lick my fingers. And they've been doing it their entire baseball life, so to speak.
And it's completely second nature, right? You know, we all have little tics and habits that we get, especially when we're under stress, that we don't realize what we're doing, right? Chewing your tongue, twisting your hair, grabbing your ear, whatever. And as you said, pitchers get the ball back, like, you know, go to their mouth. They're allowed to do. It's cold out, so you're allowed to blow into your hand. Baseball in November in Chicago. They're allowed to blow into their hand on the mound. Not anymore. So there's a whole litany of things that's going to change this game, and that's what I'm saying from the stand, the point of view of the fans. Are they going to be able to tolerate such a different version of the game? Because it's not just no crowd. It's not just no, you know, no noise and masks and all that stuff. It's all the little things that make baseball baseball. I mean, are you allowed to fix your gloves 62 times like they all do? I mean, I don't know. You're allowed to do that? Maybe you are. Maybe you're not. You know, how far back are umpires going to stand to watch the games? What happens if there's a call that somebody doesn't like? You're not allowed to go out and argue with the umpire because you're going to be spitting on him. Are you allowed to stand there and say, I disagree? All right, noted. Get back in the dugout. Practice social distancing.
Yeah. Well, Michael, you mentioned the tongue, so of course I'm reminded of Michael Jordan. Last episode of Last Dance, I thought the last 5 minutes, the story, first of all, the Pearl Jam song, and then, you know, the story of burning the notes in the can and old man Jordan walking away. I just thought the way that ended was fantastic.
Yeah, and look, the whole thing was done well, but we just have to remember a few things, right? A, this is a version of what happened presented by Michael Jordan, who had, you know, last, you know, say on everything. Presented, you know, in a way, and you're already getting the fallout. Horace Grant is not very happy. Scottie Pippen is not very happy. The people who wouldn't talk, you know, from the Jazz, Brian Russell, and Karl Malone are not so happy with this. You know, the only person who's going to be happy with it is Michael Jordan because it's his story that everybody's gushing over. So, well done. I mean, look, there's no doubt that it's produced well, that it's edited well. And I love, you know, I have become more and more enamored of the idea of the flashbacks and everything. It's been a must-see TV, appointment viewing. Think about this. What is it that you watch in real time anymore? Nothing except sporting events. We on demand, stream. We don't have to worry about when it's on. But everybody was parked in front of their couch at 9 p.m. to watch this thing on Sunday night. Tremendous event.
What stood out to you that you weren't aware of before?
I guess I really didn't know. And I've been in a lot of NBA locker rooms and in the corridors and the bowels of arenas. I didn't really realize how much Jordan was unable to live even remotely a normal existence. You know, when NBA players show up to games, they drive their cars in, they enter where the players enter, they walk through the corridors. We always see the pictures of them on TV and walk into the locker room. And they get in the locker room and they're, you know, it's their sanctuary. And they go out on the court and you got security. The amount of people that surrounded Jordan and wanted a piece of him and wanted to get just in his, airspace, which is so funny to think of these days, but the amount of people that just wanted to be near him was so overwhelming. So that just to get, if he's on the road, from the hotel into the locker room, then the locker room to the arena, I mean, onto the floor, then back, then out. And, oh, by the way, he's got to be the greatest basketball player of all time every single time he goes out and plays, because an off night means that somebody who spent money to see him goes away disappointed. That's what really stood out, is the length that he had to go just to get onto the court.
Hey, Michael, just to bring you back to LeBron in this whole thing, I saw an ESPN poll comparing LeBron and Jordan, and they broke it down into, I don't know, maybe 10 different categories: better shooter, who do you want to have the ball and the final shot, who's the better teammate, who's the better defensive player. In every single category, Jordan won. And I agree with most of them, but there are like three or four that I most certainly – first of all, Jordan was not a better passer than LeBron. LeBron's one of the great passers I've ever seen from that position in the NBA. And there were like three or four categories where I think it was clear LeBron was better. I'm not saying he's a better player, but how do you compare those two? Because that brings up the old debate, right? Or I guess it's not that old. But LeBron versus Kobe versus Michael, who's the greatest ever play of the game? Is there any doubt in your mind who it is?
No, there isn't. But here's the thing about these surveys, right? Who did they survey? 600 fans? Do you know what their ages were? Do we know what their levels of real understanding of basketball are? Or were these just the first 600 people to answer the call? That's you know, the random sampling there, when you look at statistics, and I did horribly in statistics in college. I thought I'd be figuring out batting averages, and I'm learning about the central limit theorem, or not learning about it. So I lost interest very quickly. But when you're going to do something that has to have a statistical basis in it, you need to have a very good sampling of people. And if you're going to be asking questions like this, you need to have people that can prove that they're not just casual fans or fan boys and girls who are like, well, I'm a LeBron guy or I'm a Jordan guy, so I'm going to vote for Jordan in every category, whether or not it's correct. You know, I used to stuff the ballot box when I was a kid. I would get 2,000 All-Star ballots when I went to Phillies games, and I would fill out 2,000 All-Star ballots, stuff in the ballot box for the Philadelphia Phillies. Whether I thought the players at the positions were the best and most deserving, I didn't care. I wanted 2,000 votes going for the Phillies. So I throw that away. Now, if you want to talk about their relative strength, nobody of the three, if I were going to rate them on athletic ability, and look, somebody who's 6'8", 270, who can move the way LeBron James can, is a freak of nature. But when it comes to the ability to change direction and move the way Jordan did, he's not in the same category. Kobe's closer to that than LeBron is. It would be interesting to see how LeBron's game would be different in an era where people were allowed to touch you and bump you, and when you went up for a layup, really body you, because that's not happening now. And what would happen with Jordan if he were able to be moving without anybody doing, you know, putting so much as a finger on him without a foul called against him? So I think Jordan is the best ever. I think that you can't match his competitive fire. And, you know, Kobe was his late career story said, yeah, he's a competitive monster. But early on, he was petulant because he wasn't getting what he felt was the right respect and attention on a team that Shaquille O'Neal was clearly the alpha male on.
Michael, what did you make of the whole pizza thing? That was the first time I'd heard that it was, you know, food poisoning instead of the flu. And, you know, there was a guy in Utah talking about that night. He remembers delivering the pizza. There's a story about Michael spitting on the pizza so nobody else would eat it. I thought that part was pretty interesting. And then he goes out and gets like 38 points.
Yeah.
I thought that was a pretty interesting little tidbit.
The first thing that gets me about all of this is that the word flu is being used improperly. Influenza, which is the full term for flu, is a respiratory ailment. It is not anything to do with your guts. He had a stomach virus or he had food poisoning. So you could, the way I looked at it is that, you know, I had food poisoning one time in my life, and it was a brutal 16 hours. You know, you can't do anything. So for him even to get to the arena was pretty impressive, because, you know, the term both ends burning really applies then, right? so
Dave can relate.
You better not sneeze, right? Because you might get a toy surprise. So the whole thing is just getting there. But you could tell as the game wore on, when you have food poisoning and you start to come out of it, you don't have a virus. You don't have an infection. You don't have something like this. So as the body starts to purify itself, you know, through the purging of this stuff that's poisoned you, you start to feel a little better. So as you watch the highlights of him as the third and fourth quarters, you could tell he was feeling a little better. He was still weak as hell, and it was a monumental effort to get, you know, to do what he did. So unbelievable performance. You know, now the thing is, you hear the stories. Okay, five guys weren't there. It was one guy. The guy who delivered it was a Jordan fan. He named his kid after Michael Jordan. Who knows all this? The fact of the matter is, you know, was he? Somebody was saying, you know, is he hungover? Well, you know, all the conspiracy theories start now. They didn't call up and say, "Hey, I want a pizza from Michael Jordan." That's the one. You know, I don't think Tim Grover called up and said, "Hey, can you deliver a pizza for somebody who may or may not be named Michael Jordan?" So I don't know how they knew to, you know, add extra botulism to the pepperoni pizza. You know what I mean?
Hey, Michael, we blew it last week. We didn't have time to get to the changes. ESPN, the Monday Night Football booth, Joe Tessitore and Booger McFarland are out. Steve Levy, Lewis Riddick, Dan Orlovsky, and Pat McAfee being mentioned as possible replacement candidates. What do you think of that whole situation?
Well, first of all, getting rid of Tessitore and McFarland is outstanding. As I wrote in El Hombre this past week, Tessitore made a 2nd-and-8 run off tackle for 2 yards in the first quarter sound like the Hindenburg blew up. So that was, it's good. He just it was too much at all times. And that voice, here we are now. It was as if he was affecting the announcer's voice. Booger McFarland, if he gave inane analysis, that was a step up for what he was saying. So this is Monday Night Football. This is Gifford, Meredith, Cosell. This is iconic people in the booth. And then we get these guys. Now, Steve Levy, I think, will do a very good job. I think Orlovsky is good. Lewis Riddick is very good. McAfee's a little too strange, okay? He tries a little too hard. So adding him in to try to be the Don Meredith guy, Don Meredith was down home, legitimately down home. I'll go with Levy and Orlovsky and Riddick. Let's leave the fun and games off of this, and let's bring Monday Night Football back to something people want to watch.
He is El Hombre, Michael Bradley, with us every Tuesday at 5 o'clock. You can follow him on Twitter at Daily Hombre. At Daily Hombre is where you're going to find him on Twitter. Interact at your own risk, as I like to tell you, Michael. Great stuff. Stay healthy. Social distance, all that good stuff. We'll talk to you next week.
Wear some masks, sucker.
El Hombre is brought to you by LoanEstimateReview.com.
All right, there you go. Michael Bradley with us again every Tuesday at 5 o'clock for Radio Gold for at least 20 minutes. Coming up, Jim made some predictions for the Seahawks season in a story that's on 710sports.com. You can go check it out right now. We're going to give you ours and want to hear yours as well. Prediction time coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Oh, Jim Moore has done it this time. I tell you what, he's written a doozy over at 710sports.com. 10 really random predictions for the Seahawks 2020 season. Check that out. Comment on it. Jim likes the comments. Jim, I was reading through these, and I find them entertaining. I'm going to say I disagree with the majority of them, but there are some really fun. I do like number 6. That one really made me laugh. But do you want to go through your predictions, and we'll give some of ours?
Sure, that sounds good, Bob. So now let me ask you something before I get started. Did you see the story was posted last week? Did you read it just for, you know, entertainment purposes last week, or did you just read it last minute when you saw that it was on the show sheet and we were talking about it today?
I glanced at it last week. I didn't go through the whole thing. I got sidetracked, and then I read it last night, and then I just now reread a couple during the break. So you could say I've gone over it three times.
I'm just giving you a hard time. No, I just threw out some predictions. Yeah, and I think I'm going to go, let's say, 6 out of 10. If I went 6 out of 10,
go
although
Bob, work your way up, 10 to number 1.
You think I'm going to go 0 for 10. I'm not going to mention all of them because that would bore the hell out of people probably. But I don't think you'll go
0 for 10.
You don't think I'll go 0 for 10. So you think Anthony Gordon will be the backup to Russell Wilson then? That's one of the predictions.
That's one I disagree with.
Okay, do you disagree that this will be Bobby Wagner's last year with the Seahawks? And I'm saying that because next year he's going to be 31 years old making $18 million.
I see a restructure in his future and he'll be back with the team.
Okay, do you think KJ will be a cap casualty this year?
No, I do not, because they paid him his roster bonus. I think if they were going to make a move, they would have done it before they paid him that money.
All right. Well, I'm 0 for 3 then. I think I'm going to go 1 for 4 on this one. I think you're going to agree with this, and Dave, you might too. Greg Olsen will be the third leading receiver on this team this year. He had 52 catches last year. I understand that he's 34 or 35, but he had 52 catches with Kyle Allen throwing him the ball there in Carolina. He's got Russell Wilson this year. You look at the Seahawks last year, Tyler Lockett led the team with 82, DK Metcalf with 58. Jacob Hollister with 41 last year was the third leading receiver, so I think it's going to be a tight end again this year, and it'll be Greg Olsen this time around.
I think that's a pretty good bet.
You like that one, Dave?
Well, I think it's going to be Will Disley.
Disley, okay.
I just don't know if he's going to be healthy.
Yeah, the tight end, though, might be the third leading receiver. So, yeah, that's not too much of a stretch. The only inconsistency I see there is that Greg Olsen is old, according to you. Yeah, you're making this prediction.
Well, he's not 43, Dave.
Okay. You're not old until you're 40, I guess.
I'm not sure where the line is drawn ever with Jim, but the backup quarterback thing, no. I'm with Bob. Maybe Bobby Wagner restructures, or maybe comes out and just has another all-pro year, and they're happy with him. But the 158 yards rushing and 342 yards passing. There's no way Pete comes out and says that he liked what he saw in his base defense. So that was a funny one, though. I thought that was pretty funny. But I don't know about KJ Wright. Yeah, I mean, there's a couple in here that are decent, but you said they're really random, Jim. So you don't expect to have like an 80% hit rate, right?
I'll take decent as a compliment from you, Dave. Here's one. Now, you guys probably have your own predictions. If you had to guess, here's one I just came up with. If you had to guess a year in which Russell Wilson is sacked fewer times than sacks recorded by the Seahawks, what year do you think that would be? Or do you think we'll ever see that in the rest of his career? You know, so, because he's been sacked, I think, 52 times last year, 54 the year before. So if he got down in the neighborhood of Russell getting sacked 40 to 42 times, you could maybe think about it being possible that the Seahawks could record that many sacks. Do you think we'll see that at all in the rest of
not this year?
Well, no, not this year, yeah. But if you had to guess.
I don't think so, because, I mean, he's been top 10 most sacked quarterback like 5 or 6 times, I think. So, yeah, it's just part of the cost of doing business with Russell, and it's not so much his fault a lot of times, but a lot of times he extends plays and stuff. So, yeah, I think that would be – I remember the last time I think they got 50 sacks was 2005, and they were number one in the NFL that year, and that's the year they went to the Super Bowl.
Jim, I think number 6 is the one that caught me. Number 6 on Jim's list, and again, you guys can check out this article at 710sports.com. Number 6, at some point this season, the Seahawks will give up 158 yards rushing and 342 yards passing in the same game, but Carroll will still say he liked what he saw from his base defense.
Well, he will. I think I'll go 1 for 1 on that one.
Yeah. That was good. That one's good. Yeah. Like it. I'm going to go out on a limb and say they're going to run. I don't know what the ratio nickel versus base was last year. And, Dave, maybe you've got those numbers. But I'm going to say it will be decidedly lower. I know he's sort of emphasized, we were better in base and he's got no problems. He's going to paint the rosy picture. I think we're going to see a lot less base defense than we saw last year.
Well, we'll see about that. Yeah, I don't know. They sure liked it last year.
Prediction to make because they're going to have better players.
How about number two? After Brian Schottenheimer decides to open it up and let Wilson throw 45 passes against the Giants, only to see the Seahawks lose, the let Russell cook people finally shut up and turn off the stove.
Yeah, I understand where Jay keeps. I mean, I think he's the president of the cooking people, by the way. I know I'm exaggerating saying 45 passes, and I know Jake doesn't want that kind of thing. He just wants to see him be more aggressive and maybe get closer to 30 passes a game, that type of thing, and increase by, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever. But and Jake could explain it a lot better than I'm doing right now. But I just like the formula the way it is. It's been a winning formula, and I don't see any reason to change it.
Well, and I'll say this, and I think we lost Dave there. But, Jim, I'll say this, that I don't think they're gonna be likely to change anything with the passing game. If he's averaging 26 passes a game, maybe it's by a pass or two. I think it's going to be more about the tempo. I think that would be a prediction I would make, is that you're going to see a different tempo, that maybe you're not going to see every play clock down in the red numbers, down to 3, 2, 1, please hike it, please snap the ball, please snap the ball. I think we might see it. That would be maybe the most noticeable change in terms of letting Russell cook. I don't know that it's going to be the number of passes. I think it's going to be the tempo.
I'm with you on that. I'd like to see that, Bob.
Yeah, and I think we got Dave back. What do you think of that, Dave?
I'm sorry, I missed the part, the up-tempo. Is that what you're talking about?
That I don't think we're going to see an increase in the number of times he throws the ball on average. Obviously, individual games will dictate that. But overall, I think their philosophy will be the same. They'll still be a running team. He's not going to be chucking the ball 30, 35 times a game. But I do think we may see a substantial difference in the tempo.
Yeah, it's possible they might mix that in there, too. So, yeah, the offense was really good last year. I mean, they were top 10. I think they were 18th when Schottenheimer came in his first year, and then they were 8th last year. So, not a huge amount of change needed there. But, look, Russ was able to win 12 games, and I don't feel like that there's anything drastic that needs to be done. But, you know, the thing about Russ, I mean, statistically he doesn't, you know, it doesn't really benefit him to throw a whole bunch more. I mean, he can do it, but it's not a great formula for winning. So, but you know, it's nice to know that if he has to, he can do that. I think it was that Pittsburgh game in 2016 where he just went crazy and was just throwing the ball all over the place, and they end up winning that game. But they'll try some different things. But I think the good news is you got, for the third year in a row, you've got Schottenheimer working with Russell Wilson, so that should really help out the offense quite a bit.
All right. Again, you can check out Jim's story. Head to 710sports.com. You can check out his 10 bold predictions. There's some good humor in some of these, some good stuff. So check them out and comment. Jim likes comments on his story. So check that out. Coming up, it's time for Dave Wyman's undrafted free agent profile. Today he looks at a pair of defensive tackles. He's going to break them down next here with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Another reminder, you can listen to our show via the 710 Sports app. It's powered by Dubin Law Group. You can download it for free right now, and then you've got access to everything. You can take us with you, enjoy the sunshine, listen to the show. You can listen to podcasts, everything right at your fingertips. So download that app if you don't already have it. Dave Wyman has been doing yeoman's work, just propping up in front of a monitor, breaking down undrafted free agents. He went through every single Seahawks draft pick from this season, and now he's gone through the undrafted free agents they've acquired, and today he takes a look at a pair of defensive tackles. What'd you see, Dave?
Yeah, a couple of rookie undrafted guys, Cedric Lattimore and Josh Avery, and you know, it got me thinking about the guys that play those inside defensive tackle positions, and I was just kind of going through, number one, my favorite guys, and I'll start with guy probably not a lot of people know, Greg Cragen, who was in Denver. And in 13 years, he got 28.5 sacks. And so it was like 2+ per year. But that guy, just he allowed other guys to make plays, and it was just so much more than that. Another guy, Joe Nash, which all Seahawk fans know, 47 and a half sacks in 15 years. So, you know, he blocked 10 kicks also, you know, 3-plus sacks per year. Cortez Kennedy, the best as far as Seahawks go, 58 sacks in 11 years, so we got 5-plus a year. But, you know, it makes you appreciate how good Aaron Donald is because he's playing that same inside position. It's really hard to get numbers. And these guys, you know, you're not going to get blown away by the numbers that they have. But Aaron Donald right now is averaging 12 sacks a year in that inside, you know, rush position. So pretty impressive. So, you know, and I was looking, kind of comparing, remember the year that Jaron Reed had 10 and a half sacks. And, you know, you look around the league, there's not many guys that can do that. Calais Campbell, you know, he averages about 7, a little bit more than that. So, but anyway, yeah, these guys are just going to be the guys that, you know, they do the yeoman's work that you just mentioned, Bob, where they just it's not a lot of glory in that position. You know, you're just not going to get a ton of stats, but you're going to allow your teammates to make plays. So first guy I looked at, Cedric Lattimore from Detroit. He's a Detroit kid, and his first love was actually basketball, and his basketball coach told him, hey, you know, you need to go out for football. So, okay, he goes out for football, ends up getting 17 sacks his senior year. So he got a scholarship offer to Iowa, and that's where he played. He was honorable mention all Big Ten his senior year. But Cedric Lattimore, 6'3", about 300 pounds out of Iowa, started all 13 games last year, and really pretty good production. I mean, 44 tackles and 3.5 tackles for loss, 2.5 sacks, 4 quarterback pressures, and he also had a fumble recovery. So, and you look at his stats as far as in, you know, for his entire career there, 81 tackles. So he got, you know, half of his tackles his senior year. He got 6 sacks total, forced fumble, fumble recovery. So, but really hard to move, really good, and pretty athletic for a big guy. So 6'3", 300. The next guy, Josh Avery, is even bigger. And this guy is really difficult to move. Now he's playing at Southeast Missouri State, so, you know, it's not like he's facing Big Ten type of or Big 12 type of competition. But, you know, he did have pretty good production. But the thing I'm looking at with him, he's 6'3", 325 pounds, ran a 5.140, which isn't great. His 225 bench rep was 31. So this guy's really strong. And not only that, he's got a 34.5-inch vertical. So his max on the bench is 465. So those guys, you know, you've got to be strong. It also indicates that he works hard. You know, so, I mean, a guy that, you know, gets 31 reps, he's in good shape, you know, benches 465, 20 tackles, 6 tackle for loss his senior year, a sack and a half. So, but he grew up in Nashville, and he started playing football at age 5. And you'll like this, Bob. He started off when he was younger. He was not only a wrestler, but he was also a mixed martial arts guy.
There you go.
I knew that there you would like that, so.
I like
so hand-to-hand combat. Yeah, so hand-to-hand combat is a big thing with him. And for with both of these guys, and I was reading some of the interviews, they both said, look, here's the thing that we really need is just coaching, you know, and we need to refine. They both made comments about the fact that they need to, you know, get their technique down and refine what they, you know, what they do. And down inside, I mean, I always used to joke around with the defensive tackles that, yeah, you either go straight, left, or right. But, you know, there's not a lot of assignment challenges. But what there is just how to use your hands. And it's so important how to use them down inside. So, and then, you know, once you get a guy like that who's good enough, and I was thinking about this the other day, Taylor Jacobs put a put like a little, I had a bunch of my highlights from the NFL where it was on a disc, and so he put it onto a website for me and everything. And so there was a one of the games we were playing the Giants, and actually Bill Parcells was doing the game as the color guy. And it was, it's amazing how that guy's eye for football, because Cortez and I had this little thing where, you know, he would go inside and I'd go out and I'd go, or he'd go outside and I'd go in, and we kind of just talked about it before. And this, one of the best hits that I got in the league was because we played this little game where he went inside and I went outside, and Bill Parcells calls it. He's like, yeah, they were doing that all game. And, you know, this time, you know, Tez went inside and I went out. And so, yeah, it's just when you learn that kind of, you know, that kind of stuff, those little nuances, and we talk about these guys playing together, Jaron Reed missing those first 10 games. I mean, I knew exactly what Cortez was going to do. And, you know, and he kind of knew that I was going to play off of him. So I used to always say I was like the pilot fish that follows the shark around and kind of just, you know, eats up the scraps that the shark, you know, leaves behind. So that's the kind of thing that you can get down when you get into the NFL and you start playing with guys like Bobby Wagner. You know, those are the kinds of things that, that can happen later on. And, you know, these are the kind of guys that, you know, big, strong, low to the ground. And that'll probably be the biggest challenge for them is playing low. I mean, that's one thing that you just have to. I was just watching I can't remember. It was some game. Oh, I know. It was a Hard Knocks thing where the D-line coach was telling this guy, you just have to get lower. You have to. And it's just one of those things that you're going to have to make that transition going into the NFL. So these guys are big guys that have been slugging it out their whole careers. They're, you know, playing inside. It's like being in a phone booth, you know, which is like a 4x4 space for people that don't know what a phone booth is. And, you know, you have to find a way to, you know, to win inside. And so these guys both talking about the technique for Josh Avery and Cedric Lattimore. I really liked hearing that they mentened that and that they really want to be coached up.
That's
promising. I'll tell you, Dave, one of the things about that position, I would think those guys have a better opportunity than some of the other undrafted free agents, because you've got Jaron Reed, Brian Monet, you got Puna Ford, DeMarcus Christmas as defensive tackles on the roster. Some swing guys who can play inside, I suppose, with Collier and Jackson. But, boy, and we know about the Seahawks giving undrafted free agents a chance here. Puna Ford's an example of that. And so, yeah, one of these guys might flash and end up on the roster come September.
All right, coming up next, one of my all-time favorite segments on this show. It is What We Learned, and it's coming up next with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wow, you sure know a lot of stuff.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
So much learning happening today on this show. It's going to be hard to sift through all of the nuggets that were put on display through 4 hours of Radio Gold. I'm certain of that, DJ.
Yeah, we're going to try our best, though. We had to pick from a large selection today.
All right, what did we learn?
Well, first we learned that Bruce Irvin still might be digesting that $800 steak.
He ordered some ridiculous steak that was like, I don't know how many ounces. And I remember Howie asking the waiter, you know, what did you charge him for it? And it was like $800 or something like that.
For one steak?
So I don't know if he... Yes. I mean, it was an insane amount of meat that he ate. And that guy's always just... He's one of those guys that can... remember Julian Peterson? He would eat McDonald's and everything, and that guy didn't have an ounce of fat on him. So, but yeah, it sounds like he's taking a little bit better care of himself now. And I'm not sure how many days it took him to pass that steak, but it's probably out of his system by now. But
well, you pay $800 for a single steak. You want it to stay with you as long as possible, don't you? Get your money's worth.
Yeah, you know, it could have been like the total bill for him or something like that, but I'm pretty sure it was like just this enormous chunk of steak, and I don't know if he took any home, but he had just signed his big,
huge
deal with the Raiders, yeah, probably, but yeah, he just signed his big deal there, so he could afford it.
It just didn't occur to me, Dave, on how long it was going to take to pass, but it did occur to me that... Have you guys ever had Wagyu beef, or however you say that? Because I never have.
Yeah.
Wagyu. I've never had that. I've heard Dave talk about it a lot in the past, but I've never actually had it.
It's how good is
really
it?
Good. You don't put A1 or ketchup on it, I can tell you that much.
What else did we learn, DJ?
we learn that King Felix really misses Shannon Dreyer.
All right, Felix, I want to end it with this. How much are you going to miss Shannon Dreyer when you're in Atlanta?
Oh, my goodness. Don't worry. We're going to get back to Seattle. Don't worry. I'm going to. Hey, by the way, say hi to Shannon. I'm missing. I miss her a lot. She was a pain in the ass, but I'm not just kidding. I'm just kidding. Don't listen to that.
No, come on, Felix. We all love Shannon.
No, we all love her. Yeah, I love Shannon, too. She's amazing. She always supports my career, so I love him.
Look at Jim jumping in. We all love Shannon.
Shut up, Bobby.
Oh.
Yeah, we all do.
You know, Jim loves Shannon. I don't know if Shannon loves Jim.
Yeah. Shannon loves me, too.
It's debatable.
Maybe.
Well, I just knew that she and Felix, I mean, she's like the Felix Whisperer, isn't she? I mean, she knew him probably better than any other reporter.
Yeah, there's a good chance.
How about this?
She's around him his entire career.
How about this one, when Shannon's phone was beeping? What was more annoying, the beeping or Shannon herself? And that's not something that Jim would not say to Shannon's face. But Shannon finally blocked Jim on Twitter because, quote, she had had enough, which I thought was one of the better quotes in sports radio history.
Nice guy, Jim.
We have a weird relationship.
Is she in that category of people that have wanted to punch Jim at one point or another?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Probably. She couldn't reach my face though.
Oh, see, here we go. Okay, let's move on. DJ, what else did we learn?
Jim, we learned a little bit about a certain type of doll.
A South Korean soccer club that's apologized for being accused of putting mannequins in the empty seats during a match to simulate a crowd, but apparently they were sex dolls. So FC Seoul expressed sincere remorse over the controversy, but insisted in a statement that it used mannequins, not sex dolls, to mimic a home crowd during the match on Sunday. Now, if that's true, what are they apologizing for?
Well, maybe they chose them because they look like they're yelling. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the reason would be.
That was the line of the day right there. That was fantastic.
Yeah. You almost made one of the listeners drive off the road with that one, Dave.
I wasn't quite sure about that one, but there's some other characteristics of those sex dolls that apparently might lead you to believe that they're used for something other than sporting clothes or
that they were not mannequins.
Member. Yeah. So, that was pretty funny, man. That's entertaining. Yeah. That's one of the better sweeping the dials we've had.
I still want to see video of that if it exists.
Yeah. It has to. It's got to be out there somewhere.
Well, somebody was saying, well, they couldn't tell that they weren't, but weren't they taking the mannequins or the sex dolls and putting, clothes like the team's, sweatshirts and stuff on there? I mean, it should have become obvious at some point.
What else did we learn, DJ?
Yeah, let's just get off that subject real quick. We learned that Dave had a similar experience to the flu game.
Hearing that story, that happened to me in Carolina for a playoff game when I was doing pre and post radio. I can't remember what year it was, like 14, 15, whenever we went out there. And I got sick from eating some deep fried cucumbers or something. And I'll just say this, that when I went to the stadium, I left a $100 bill for the cleaning lady because that's how bad I felt. So, that was just miserable and brutal. And I can't believe you went out and what, got 38 points that night or something?
$100, Dave? You left that much?
She was underpaid, Jim. Trust me. It was brutal.
Yeah, the visual you're creating, Dave, I would agree. Very underpaid.
Oh, man. It was so miserable. And I just remember laying there and waking up at like 7 o'clock. I think I woke up at 3. And I won't tell you what woke me up. But, yeah, and then, you know, thinking, oh, man, I'm going to have to head to the park. And then when we went to, it was snowing in Carolina and it was cold. And I was as miserable, I think, as I've ever been. But, yeah, so I felt bad for Jordan. It's pretty amazing. I'll tell you what, I had a flu going into a game one time where, you know, I was like 103-degree temperature, throwing up, everything. And I, you know, played a Sunday night game. And I swear to you, after the game, I was fine. It's like I played that out of me. And I think I ended up going out and having beers after the game. But it was a Sunday night game against the Raiders. I was sick as a dog. And then playing that game, it just kind of purged everything out of my system.
Well, and the thing is that when you're that sick like you were in Carolina, you want to try and clean up after yourself, but you can't even do it.
Oh, I tried.
Yikes.
I tried, but yeah, there was still...
He said, "I'll just
weren't enough
get
towels
rid of this with cash." Oh
yeah.
God! Anything
else? Any more
DJ?
Details you want to hear, Bob? Should I keep going?
No, I think story? I'm up to speed on that whole incident. Yeah.
Alrighty.
DJ, anything else?
No, we didn't learn anything else today.
All right, I think that was enough learning right there. Good stuff today. Ryan Roland Smith, the King, Felix Hernandez, John Clayton, and El Hombre, Michael Bradley, all guests of the show. If you missed anything, you missed a lot. So head to 710sports.com, click that podcast button, click on our picture, and everything you missed is waiting for you there each and every day. We're going to be back with you tomorrow right here with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Bruce, no!